going to mug me?
Am I going to mug you?
Is that gorgeous or what, eh?
And I believe I can run a decent marathon.
Download Veely now.
Welcome to the dark world of the Lady Killers. Why do people kill? If there's one thing I've learned in my time as a crime writer, it's that there are a million and one motives for murder. But in the case of a serial killer, what could be the motive for not one, but a lifetime of murders? Power, corruption, blackmail, or maybe the most common one of all, money, or more precisely, greed. This is Amelia Dyer, perhaps Britain's most prolific serial killer, a woman who is notorious for many years but whose name is barely known today. She was no oil painting, but there are many more reasons why it would be hard to paint a pretty picture of the life and times of Amelia Dyer. Amelia Dyer killed for money. Nothing new in that, even in Victorian England. But what is astonishing about Amelia is that all of her victims were newborns. Amelia Dyer delivered, fostered, and adopted illegitimate babies for money.
If you gave her £5 and the baby, she would take the baby and either have it adopted out or raise it herself. But of course, what she really did was kill it and take the £5.
Amelia Dyer was a murderer. And she knew what she was doing. This was a calculated career plan that she'd embarked on and sustained over 30 years, come what may.
She says she felt peaceful after she put the baby's body in the river. She used to look at them and derive some kind of pleasure and some kind of perverted maternal perspective on these babies who she just killed. You know, as they're lying there, she gets some kind of glow.
Using many aliases and addresses, Amelia Dyer evaded detection for decades, despite complaints of police and the pursuit of young mothers desperate to know the fate of their babies.
She disposed of a lot of them straight away by throwing them in rivers. But we also believe that she kept hold of the parcels for a while until the bodies decomposed, so that there would be no chance of the babies being traced back to her.
The letters that survive tell of an articulate, persuasive and plausible woman rather than a savage butcher who killed and killed again for a period of 30 years.
She wrote these adverts that were very cleverly crafted, saying that the child would be looked after and they'd been wanting a child for a long time and it would be loved, it would be a caring home. All these things were hitting exactly the right buttons for a young mum who, you know, was giving a child up.
In 1896, Amelia Dyer's career caught up with her. The body of a baby that she'd adopted and murdered was found in a package dumped in the river and was traced back to her address. At the time of her arrest, Amelia Dyer was 56, a stocky middle-aged woman with grey and brown hair, the ordinariness of the picture betraying an evil within.
Cold, heartless, unfeeling. Those kids meant nothing to her. It was just a means of getting money.
Upon her arrest, it emerged that she had narrowly escaped discovery on several occasions, even preferring to be committed as insane rather than face up to her crimes.
I don't think Amelia Dyer was insane. I think she was a very bad person who deliberately committed murder for profit.
I am fascinated by Amelia Dyer, not just because of the savage nature of her crimes and the innocence of the victims, but also because of the sheer volume.
This was a 30-year career, and at her worst, we know that there were 6 babies a day, various other points, 6 babies a week. Even if this was one infant death a month, over 30 years, you're looking at 400.
But who was Amelia Dyer? And what made her kill this shocking number of children over such a long period of time? And how could such horrific crimes be so very easily forgotten? As a crime author, I'm intrigued by what circumstances and forces combine to create crimes and criminals. And nowhere is this more gripping than in the story of the 19th century baby killer, Amelia Dyer. Amelia Dyer prematurely ended the lives of an estimated 400 babies. I'm interested to know what would prompt this woman to richly kill babies she was being paid to look after. I want to find out all that I can about the real Amelia Dyer. But because she lived in Victorian times, there are actually no living witnesses and no people who are close to her. So I'm going to start my search with all that's left of her. This is Thames Valley Police Museum, and all the evidence relating to Amelia Dyer is kept here, so I'm going to go through now and see what they've got. So, Ken, who was Amelia Dyer?
Mrs. Dyer was a lady who set up quite a lucrative business of fostering children that couldn't be looked after by the mother or father. And she would adopt them for a fee for looking after the child, which could be something like 20, 30, 40 pounds.
I know you shouldn't sort of accuse people because of what they look like, but she does look like quite a stern person, doesn't she?
Absolutely, yes.
I don't know if I'd be quite happy leaving any of my children with her.
No.
Amelia Dyer's lifetime was Victorian England, a time of social extremes where a person's life chances were randomly dictated by factors of class and wealth.
Dickens did a really good job of describing social conditions in the 1850s and 60s. Certainly there were a lot of poor people, there were a lot of neglected and abandoned children.
Victorian England has been recorded as a time when family values were a priority, and it's a period that Margaret Thatcher revered and tried to revive in the 1980s. But a closer examination of the history of that period paints a very different picture.
There was no work, there was no social services, there was no welfare. One in every 12 women was a prostitute. A child being born under normal circumstances only had a 50% chance of reaching the age of five. So that's how bad it was.
Dead infants or abandoned infants were as commonplace on the streets of British cities as roadkill today. Babies were found parcelled up in railway stations under railway arches.
It was desperation by the vast majority of these ladies.
The whole illegitimacy thing was seen as hugely immoral. Even orphanages would only accept orphans from families where the parents were married and the father had died. They wouldn't accept a child who was born out of wedlock.
By the mid-1800s, Victorian society was facing widespread poverty and a rising illegitimacy epidemic, and new laws were needed to address these problems.
In 1834, the British government passed the Poor Law Amendment Act, and this was one of those spectacular pieces of Victorian wisdom aimed at preventing premarital relations. Because what it did was to actually exacerbate an already existing problem, because men could father illegitimate children and not be expected to pay for the consequences, leaving women stranded completely.
Abortion was not an option that most people considered. So the simplest thing to do was hide, have the baby, and get rid of it. Pay somebody to take care of it, or pay somebody to get rid of it.
Designed to protect the sanctity of family life, the illegitimacy laws would backfire and create new social problems. The biggest one of these would turn out to be the baby farmers. So, Kim, what was exactly baby farming?
Baby farming was a business carried out throughout the country whereby if a mother was unable to look after their child, there was an option of sending it to a baby farmer, or known as fostering, on the understanding that they could go and visit the child whenever they wanted to.
Farming out literally is where the expression comes from, either on a weekly fee, in which case they're referred to as nurse children, or on a permanent basis for a one-off sum.
They were actually providing a service, legitimate ones. They were what the welfare does today. You would take a child that was abandoned or was not wanted and then give them to a foster parent. And that's what these people were doing for money.
Established to assist with the adoption and fostering of children, baby farming was a lucrative practice. While many acted in good faith, it was unregulated and unpoliced and therefore open to exploitation.
Had the bad ones, like Amelia Dyer, who started getting rid of the children they couldn't pass on to other foster parents.
You took the babies in, you got quite a reasonable fee, and then you didn't do anything with them. You let them die of starvation, or you hastened their end.
Amelia Dyer would become the most notorious baby farmer of them all. Born in Bristol, far from the poverty of her day, nothing in her background would point to the path she would take.
For the time, she had a pretty good start. Her father had a good trade and paid for her to go to a church-run school, which at the time only a quarter of children her age actually got an education, so she was privileged in that respect.
Blessed with a comfortable childhood in the Bristol suburbs, life would change dramatically for Amelia when her mother contracted typhus fever and suffered from violent hallucinations and delusions.
She witnessed her mother basically losing her mind and dying a slow, horrific death. And I guess being a young girl, she may have even been called upon to, you know, nurse her mother slightly, or at least wait upon her.
Despite her young age at the time, her mother's illness and death would be a defining influence on the rest of Amelia's life.
Amelia was later to claim that her mother died as a result of hereditary insanity. And I think, though this isn't true, it's really easy to understand how she could have remembered it that way.
It would certainly have a massive impact on her, and she may have learned a few little things about what kind of symptoms may be shown by someone who is losing their mind.
The enduring memory of the severity of her mother's illness and the early demand to be a carer may have also influenced her choice to train as a nurse at the Bristol Royal Infirmary.
Amelia turned to one of the most arduous professions she could have turned to. Nursing was just starting to change. It was post-Crimean War. Nursing was starting to have a much better profile as a result of Florence Nightingale. But it was still a thankless profession.
It wasn't such a caring profession as it is present day. They'd train you psychologically to be a lot more robust around dealing with people. So she became quite hardy and emotionless from having been trained through the nursing regime.
In 1864, 26-year-old Amelia fell pregnant with her first child. Women were not allowed to continue working once their pregnancies began to show, so Amelia left nursing. But it wouldn't be long before she discovered another way of putting her training to use when a young woman called Ellen Dane came to board at her house.
Ellen Dane was a midwife, but she earned additional money taking in women who were illegitimate, who wanted to keep their pregnancies quiet. And she offered the additional service of then adopting the unwanted offspring of these women. She was a baby farmer.
Amelia could see it was a very easy way to make money, although with risks involved, obviously. And, you know, Amelia did have training as a midwife as well through her nursing experience, so it was certainly something that she knew she was capable of doing.
That was the beginning of a massive change in the direction Amelia's life was to take.
The influence of Ellen Dane would take a few years to incubate, but surfaced when Amelia's husband, George Thomas, died. And she was faced with the hard realities of being a single mother in Victorian England. Aware of the rich pickings the trade could generate, Amelia decided to open a baby farm. But first, she made a chilling and telling decision.
It was a choice that she made. She had options. She could have kept her child. She could have worked through. But instead, what she does is to farm her own child out and to opt for the easy money that she'd seen Ellen Dane able to make.
Mummy, is everything going to be okay?
As Amelia chose to go into the baby farming business, she was maybe, you know, travelling around here, there and everywhere, adopting babies, so it made sense for her daughter to be out of the way.
On any day in any newspaper, ads would run soliciting for the weekly, monthly or even yearly care of infants, all aimed at the mothers of illegitimate babies who wouldn't be able to work with the added liability of a child. In 1846, Amelia's ad started to appear alongside the rest.
She opened the doors as a house of confinement, accepting women at the point where their pregnancy was no longer concealable, and seeing them right through to the delivery of the child. And then, just as Dane had done, either saying goodbye to mother and child, offering to keep the child on a weekly fee, or a permanent adoption for a much more considerable fee.
By the mid-19th century, there are estimated to be almost 2,000 baby farmers in London alone. Such was the supply of illegitimate babies. And many, like Amelia, recruited mothers through charming and persuasive correspondence.
This one here is an advert that she read in the local paper, whereby a lady is asking, is anybody available to foster her child?
Yeah.
And she wrote a letter to the lady saying that she was prepared to foster this child.
Mm. Well, I do like the bit here where she said, I do really want a nice baby. I don't mind boy or girl. I would love either. And I don't mind a small sum to pay for it. So she obviously must have had quite a nice way with her for these people to trust her.
Amelia was already aware of the fact that this was not going to be her helping children. This was going to be a fairly cruel and anti-mothering act that would be actually carried out in order to gain all this money.
Life in the baby farms would have been grim. Domestic dormitories housing ill and sickly babies, showing the results of a savage practice.
Baby farmers use different methods that I know of, some of which are less palatable than others.
Quite often, she would smother babies at birth, suffocating the baby at the moment its head came out so that it didn't turn blue, because that was a sign that it had taken its first breath. So it would look like a stillbirth. So the death certificate would be all above board.
The one-off premiums were certainly not enough to sustain a child's life for long financially. And the only way that it would be profitable for a baby farmer was to subject a child to persistent underfeeding that would at some point bring about the infant's death. And, of course, a hungry child is a noisy child, is a difficult child to raise. And what they referred to was something that was chillingly referred to colloquially as the quietness. This was an over-the-counter anti-colic cordial, and it did contain liquid opium, which was laudanum, and, in some cases, brandy.
People gave babies laudanum who were supposed to be giving them food because it dulled the need or the awareness of the baby that it was hungry. And of course, it didn't nourish the baby, so eventually a baby that was given that and not given enough food would die.
Amelia, you know, would have been quite drawn to the idea of self-medicating, if you like, possibly seeing it as a route, you know, to ease the situation, to make it even easier for her to put up with what she was doing.
She took it on a regular basis. She took it, you know, almost daily, so she was an addict. So that would, induce a form of, state from her mentally where she'd be detached from reality. And I think that was part of her coping mechanism, to detach from, you know, reality of what she was doing.
Amelia.
By the end of the 1860s, the scale of the national infanticide epidemic had started to get noticed by Parliament, and the pressure was on for action. The high-profile arrest of Brixton baby farmer Margaret Waters in 1870 threatened Amelia's livelihood.
Margaret Waters had the misfortune to be caught having killed somebody's baby who actually didn't want the baby killed. Margaret Waters and her sister were investigated, and it was found that four other babies had died of neglect in their care in a very short period.
What the Margaret Waters case did was to confront British society, the ruling classes, with the scale of the problem of infanticide and baby farming, so that it could no longer be ignored. It turned it into a scandal for the first time, and somebody had to hang. And guilty or not, Margaret Waters had to hang.
During the course of the trial, there was evidence brought forward that connected Amelia Dyer to Margaret Waters. Amelia had worked under the pseudonyms of Mrs. Harding and Mrs. Smith, and both names were mentioned at the Old Bailey hearing, and as a result in the press. Aware that her brutal business could be exposed, Amelia went into hiding.
She saw colleagues beginning to struggle. Ellen Dane had fled the country to the States, pursued by the police. Waters had hanged. And so she gave up baby farming and moved into the anonymity of the asylum as an attendant.
Come on, it's time for tea. Come on.
She was a very clever lady. With the police getting close to her, then she needed to lose herself. And what better place but to go into somewhere like that?
For a time, it looked like Amelia was a reformed woman. She married again to William Dyer in 1872 and settled down into a standard family life. Their attempts to establish a self-sustaining life, however, were disastrous.
I've lost my job.
And when yet another business venture failed, Amelia was once again back on the farm.
Once he loses his job, that's it. She seems to go, you know, straight back into it big time.
It would be easy to argue that Amelia is the victim, the hard times forced her into ever desperate measures. But it wouldn't explain why she would return as a more menacing murderer time and time again.
Amelia committed what many serial killers do, the mistake of accelerating and being over-enthusiastic, either for reasons that she was, you know, either enjoying the process or quite simply greed was driving her over the edge.
As the pressure was increased across the country for a raise in the standards and conditions of infant care, Amelia's practices once again came under police scrutiny when four of her nurse children died within the space of 2 weeks. Suspicions were aroused and inquests were ordered into the deaths. Convinced that the full extent of her criminal career would be exposed in a court, Amelia Dyer decided on a very different ending.
Amelia Dyer took a massive laudanum overdose. She was found to have emptied 2 bottles of laudanum during the process, and she was raging, she was delusional. And her favoured phrase at the time, "I took about the right amount, I'm part doctor myself," was certainly a dose that was sufficient enough to have carried her off. She very nearly died, but the fact that she survived it at all is a very strong indication that she had a prior tolerance to the drug.
She certainly did genuinely try to kill herself, because that it was, you know, it had all fallen down around her. That was it. She was, you know, she was caught.
2 bottles of laudanum would have killed most people, but not Amelia Dyer. She had come close, but her failed attempt to take her own life was to prove a costly mistake, both for her own immediate future and the countless children who would subsequently die by her hand. Amelia Dyer is one of the most prolific British serial killers. Dyer lived in the 19th century England and had a savage and brutal career as a baby farmer. Taking advantage of the fact that illegitimate babies' lives were all but worthless in Victorian Britain. Amelia Dyer fostered and adopted babies, and then she killed them for profit. The more children she murdered, the more money she made.
In 1879, the police had a chance to nail her as a cold-blooded murderer. Amelia Dyer had been arrested after four of her infants had died suspiciously within the space of 2 weeks.
The inquests are held both in the city and in Somerset, and they're pretty certain that these babies have died as a direct result of neglect and opium overdose, but they can't prove it. And interestingly, she gets off with a six-month sentence with hard labour.
Amelia was charged under the Infant Life Protection Act, where the prosecution were required to prove that she was aware that the opiate she administered would cause death rather than assist sleep. The difference between a murderer or a carried-away carer. She managed to sidestep the gallows, but without a sympathetic coroner.
She'd have been hanged in 1879.
It's incredible, really, that she just got 6 months. There was one example we read of a chap who got sentenced to 12 months for stealing a piece of bacon.
In the long term, it mostly would have served as a very hard lesson in forensic awareness that she wasn't going to get caught again. And there was no way she was going to leave any evidence, which had been the problem leading up to her capture.
At this point in her life, Amelia is 46. If the calculation of her killing spree is correct, her toll of murders would have reached 100. I want to know how she was capable of abusing and then killing innocent babies, dependent infants that looked to her for life. I also want to know why she repeatedly returned to baby farming. Could it have been more than pure greed?
There was obviously more to it than just the money. There was something else about her that was enabling her to commit these horrific crimes.
Could Amelia Dyer have been fueled and simultaneously numbed by the laudanum and alcohol cocktail she was administering?
Certainly the drugs would have had an impact on her, without a doubt, on her mental state, maybe induced, you know, this complete detachment from reality.
A long-term laudanum habit will lead to periods of depression. They can lead to mood swings, even when you're not under the influence. I think it also exacerbates any underlying mental health issues.
If you accept she had a mental illness, did it contribute to her criminal behaviour? Or could it be that they coexisted? And I tend to think that her criminal behaviour, which went on for such a long time and which was done in such a calculated way, wasn't related to her mental illness.
The actual killing of the child and watching the child peacefully to some degree die, it parallels perhaps seeing her mother pass away, where she felt an almost godlike power over these children, that she had decided were going to go to their maker.
By 1884, pressure was mounting for the reform of the laws on infant care, and baby farming was becoming a very risky business.
There was just a change in the public attitude, and it was more risky because you were more likely to be reported if you were seen, you know, with an obviously looking sickly or abused child. She couldn't have all these neglected children lying around anymore.
She definitely changes her modus operandi at this point. She doesn't use the slow neglect. She's beginning to murder these children by strangulation.
Amelia's murderous method had become a ritual. She had developed a precise practice that chillingly maximised the efficiency of her limited resources. But that was as casual for her as it was routine.
She would go to the town where she was to collect the baby from, get the money, take the baby, get home, take out some tape, tie the tape around the baby's neck, and pull. Baby would stop breathing. She would wrap the baby in a package of brown paper, tie it up with string, and drop it into the Thames with a brick.
The idea of strangling and using the tape may seem, you know, almost symbolic or bizarre to ourselves, but in terms of criminal awareness, she was aware of the fact that if she'd tried to suffocate a baby, it's not always absolutely certain that the baby is dead. And tape around the neck meant that child was never going to come round again.
The first however many times, when it's a new thing, it's probably, you know, a difficult process, without a doubt, but the more she does it, the more desensitised she is to doing it. And I think for her, is all she kept in her mind was the end result, which was getting the money and, you know, bringing the next baby in and the next baby in.
Amelia also made a routine of her recruitment and responded daily to notices in the papers. By now, she was deliberately targeting children from wealthy families where the financial return would be greater. But climbing the social ladder as a baby farmer brought new risks. Amelia was taking on the babies of educated people, people who would not be so easy to dupe or mislead. In 1890, a young governess discovered to her cost that Amelia Dyer was not the good mother she promised or appeared to be. This young woman would be the beginning of the undoing of Amelia Dyer.
This was a young governess who had fallen in love with the young master of the house that she worked in and had got pregnant.
She was left on her own, and she responds to an advert, gets in touch with Amelia Dyer and moves in with her.
Amelia was able to gain the trust of this woman, as with many others, and so much so that the governess was persuaded to leave her baby in the care of Amelia once it was born. A couple of months later, the governess returned to pay the final payment. There
she goes. Amelia arrives cradling a baby that the governess knows is not her own. This is a 2-3-month-old child, and she knows this isn't her child. Amelia tries to fob her off. Infants change a great deal in 3 months, she tells her. But the governess strips the baby's clothes, looking for a birthmark on her child's hip, which, of course, isn't there.
I'm coming back tomorrow, and I want my baby.
But this was a tragedy that was far from over. Like many mothers before her, the governess repeatedly tried to reclaim her child from Amelia, even bringing the police with her on several occasions.
Well, miss, we have a problem.
But each time, Amelia made her familiar excuses.
No, that's not my
despite
baby.
Knowing that the baby in question had died a long time before, and by her own hand.
See you next week.
She managed to put them off time and time again by sending them on wild goose chases, pretending the baby had been adopted by a couple that lived here, a couple that lived there.
Relocation, relocation, relocation. Just one of the ways Amelia Dyer managed to evade the authorities. Aided and abetted by an endless stream of aliases and a cruel ability to string innocent parents along indefinitely. But with the governess on a trail, Amelia Dyer is once again under a spotlight and under pressure.
She did feel hounded and hunted for a good many years. Whichever way she turned, eventually there'd be a knock on the door with the governess and a police officer, and I'm sure that would have had an impact on her. She would have felt that pressure.
The governess certainly raises the very real prospect of another prison sentence, and that does seem to have a dramatic effect on Amelia's mental stability.
She suddenly has these periods where she turns completely irrational, threatens suicide. The doctor was called in and she flew at him. She was hearing voices. The birds are telling me to do it, to do it. Seemingly having a bit of an episode. So much so that she was sent to an asylum.
But is she mental or meticulous? Amelia's breakdown seemed to be timed to coincide with a possible capture, and also provided her with a convenient escape.
To get into a Victorian asylum, you needed a medical certificate and you needed the magistrate agreeing to it, so you couldn't just walk in. So I think at those stages, she was unwell.
Her breakdowns were very short-lived. Even if she did kind of have a bit of an emotional collapse, it was for a very, very short period of time, and then she picked herself up and got it all back together again. So, I mean, to me, that would say that there isn't a mental illness there.
She never fell apart while she was killing children. She never fell apart while she was disposing of bodies. She only fell apart when it looked like there might be a confrontation with the law.
From the asylum, Amelia was eventually transferred back to the workhouse in 1895. But it's clear that even here she was plotting a comeback.
She befriends an old lady called Jane Smith, who's widowed, and she's resigned to spending her last days in the workhouse. And Amelia seduces her, really, with stories of rescuing the unwanted infants of single mothers and nursing them. And it's a very, very seductive image. And Jane Smith buys into it wholesale.
Amelia's clever plot thickened. She groomed Jane Smith to be the perfect front for her next assault on the young mothers of Britain. Jane Smith was instructed to refer to Amelia as mother, and in turn Amelia would call her Granny Smith, the perfect family unit that any mother would feel comfortable surrendering their baby to.
Jane Smith didn't get the life she was promised at all. She was treated as no more than a servant, really. She was made to look after the children, to clean the house.
Amelia seems to now adopt infants with fury. So fast, they're coming and going at such a speed that Jane Smith never gets a chance to learn their names.
She never knows from one minute to the next, you know, what child's in the house, then it's taken out again.
Eyewitnesses, neighbour reports are saying that there's six infants a day coming to the house, and that as many times as they're arriving, they're seeing her leave the house with another baby. Jane Smith has no idea where these infants are going. She's beginning to feel very uneasy about the situation.
Already suspicious about Amelia's actions and intentions, the turning point for Granny Smith was just around the corner.
Granny finds a shop in Reading, which had been turned into the National Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Children Centre. And that's when she saw the photographs of the children that had been misused. And that's when Mrs. Bennett came out and asked her what was wrong.
Can I help you? How could you do this to these poor little children?
Granny said, I'm a nurse to Amelia Dyer, and she takes these children in, and before I can actually get attached with them, they disappear.
The NSPCC was 3 years old at this point and was waging war on child cruelty and mistreatment. The woman's husband was an NSPCC officer called Charles Bennett, but despite visiting Amelia Dyer's house, his concern was confined to her unregistered status and lack of records, rather than the welfare of the babies present.
He asked whether she had any licence to do this. She said she didn't, and then he reported that to the police. He also reported it to his headquarters, and his headquarters said, make a record of this and keep her under observation. And that's what he did.
Just a few weeks later, it was Granny Smith who first noticed a terrible smell coming from one of the kitchen cupboards. It seemed to be coming from a strangely wrapped parcel on the shelf.
A lodger living in one of the downstairs rooms began to complain of the smell. And so one morning, Amelia got up and characteristically early and cleaned the cupboard out, scrubbed it, and was seen to leave the house with a brown paper parcel under her arm, saying that she was going to take some clothes to the pawn shop.
There was a Thames bargeman. He was on the river and he saw this package in the river. He hooked it out and it's a brown paper parcel. Now, inside that was a body of a baby with tape around the neck. And then inside the package, there was a name and address.
Amelia had been careless. Not only had the parcel failed to sink, but one of her old addresses was still clearly visible, written within the package. But the capture of Amelia Dyer wouldn't be so cut and dried. The name on the parcel was a Mrs. Thomas, and the police would have to be as clever as a criminal to bring Amelia Dyer to trial. Amelia Dyer is one of Britain's most fascinating and prolific serial killers. In a career that lasted 30 years, she killed into the hundreds. and managed to escape detection several times. But by 1890, she had started to make mistakes.
One of the babies that had been retrieved from the river had been wrapped up in brown paper, and it hadn't been in the river terribly long. And when the police unraveled the paper, and on some of the brown paper, she had left a name and address of where she lived.
Which was one of her aliases.
Absolutely.
Mrs. Thomas at Pickett Road. Now, Pickett Road is where our Amelia Dyer was living under the name of Mrs. Thomas.
From that moment on, it was down to good old-fashioned police work to make the connection between the name and address on the parcel and Amelia Dyer.
Mrs. Dyer, can we have a word, please?
Of course.
Amelia tried to wriggle out of it, tried to pretend she wasn't who she was, that she operated by a different name, but the police had none of it.
What have we got here?
At that time, it would have only been very simple evidence. They would have been looking purely for clothing and things which would link to the children which had been found.
They found a house bulging with evidence of the adoptions of babies. Reams of letters from mothers arranging adoptions, cupboards full of clothes, and a jar stuffed full of pawn tickets where infant clothes had been pawned.
We'll have to arrest her. Can you come with me, please?
So here's Amelia's hair. Why would they have kept a lock of hair all that time ago? I mean, what were the state of the forensics in those days?
Well, I've no idea, really. I've often pondered on this, whether it was taken for forensic reasons. For example, if any of this hair could be matched to the hair on the clothing of the babies that had been retrieved from the river. But I don't really feel that the advancement of looking at hair was the same as it is today.
It seemed a bit ghoulish somehow, doesn't it, having her hair? So this is her child sheet, and it says here, she did feloniously, willfully, and with malice aforethought, kill and murder a certain female infant, Helena Fry, daughter of one Mary Fry.
Amelia was taken to the Reading police station, where the first thing she did was to attempt suicide again, this time by removing a bootlace and tying it round her neck with a knot under her right ear in the same way that she'd strangled her infants.
The police dredged the river looking for more evidence, and on the 10th of April 1896, a carpet bag containing Doris Marmon and Harry Simmons was discovered.
The carpet bag was a key piece of evidence. Amelia had a nurse child, an older boy, living in the house, and he identified the carpet bag as his own. Over the course of the dragging operations, upwards of 50 babies are pulled out of the Thames between Reading and London. And Amelia says, well, you'll know all mine by the tape around their necks.
With the noose tightening around Amelia's neck, her daughter and son-in-law were also arrested as accessories to murder. Amelia was so distressed by this that she confessed and wrote a letter taking all responsibility for the crimes.
As God Almighty is my judge in heaven as on earth, neither my daughter, Mary Ann Palmer, nor her husband, Alfred Ernest Palmer, I do most solemnly declare neither of them had anything at all to do with it. They never knew I contemplated doing such a wicked thing.
She knew the chances of her living through a trial like this and coming out and being just given a sentence of prison or something were virtually nil. Women of this stature were almost always hanged.
She decided a plea of insanity was going to be the only possible way that she was going to get off. She claimed that there was insanity in the family because of her mother.
Mama! To go for a plea of insanity, what you're effectively trying to do is stop them executing you. There's two questions that come out of that. Did she know what she was doing? Yes, she did. Did she know what she was doing was wrong? Simple question. If a police officer was standing beside you, would you have done it? No, you know it's wrong. The jury said she's sane, she's guilty.
On the 10th of June 1896, Amelia Dyer was executed at Newgate Wall. Like many of her victims, she felt a noose around her neck and suddenly knew no more. Her death closed the casebook on one of the most deadly serial killer cases in British history.
The idea that over time Amelia will have dispensed with, you know, possibly 500 children, is quite remarkable, because, you know, you would think that someone would become jaded, or at least would start to feel, you know, that some kind of pangs of conscience that you cannot carry on slaughtering these babies.
She had a final interview and she described the murdering. She described the voices that drove her to murder. And she said, "I used to like to watch them with a tape around their neck." This was a woman who grew to love what she did to these children. She grew to like the act and standing back and watching the child die.
Amelia Dyer is one of the most brutal and consistent serial killers we have come across in this series. Her crimes have to be seen in the context of the times in which she lived. Victorian England was a brutal and barbaric period where the life of a child, and bastard children especially, was worthless. So when we remember the crimes, even in history, we should always remember the victims.